pleasure to be here with everybody. I want to acknowledge, first of all, real quick, my co-authors, Oliver Droppers and Cheryl Gelman, as well as Sean Colmer with the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. So I want to start with a quick question. As somebody who has an interest in the intersection of health services delivery and healthcare policy with public administration and governance, is your primary interest in being here about collaboration and partnerships and governance? Can you raise your hands if that's primary interest? So a few people? Okay. What about more in health services delivery, particularly around health information technologies? So a little bit of both, some overlap. Right, I find it kind of fascinating to think about where those areas intersect. And this project ended up being a really interesting example of where they sometimes intersect and where they sometimes diverge. So, so in terms of disclosures, no commercial interest to disclose. The project, the evaluation research that we did on it was supported by the Office for Oregon's Health Policy and Research through a Medicaid transformation grant. So personal health records, first of all, to start with some background. Personal health records have really been lauded as having the potential to restructure and reform the health safety net, to improve service delivery, to improve access to care, to potentially lower costs. However, they differ from the more widely known or recognized electronic health records, primarily in the locus of ownership. Electronic health records are primarily owned, if you would, by a provider. Whereas a personal health record oftentimes is a freestanding, i.e. it's not tethered to a particular provider. So the state of Oregon planned to develop and implement a personal health record system using a health record bank model for its Medicaid population. This was supported through its Medicaid transformation grant. In order to establish the health record bank, it's necessary to do a couple of things. First, you need to establish a portal for the creation of the PHRs. And second, you need to conduct outreach and enrollment activities. So in order to do this, the state contracted with a commercial vendor to build and manage the technology platform, and a local nonprofit organization was then contracted to conduct community outreach and engagement activities with consumers, with providers, with community health centers, and others who assist Medicaid clients to access coverage and services. So the goals for the PHR you can see here, and obviously they have an adverb attached to them, improving access to patient health information, improving coordination, communication, continuity of care, aiding consumers or individual patients with self-care and disease management, enhancing the patient and provider decision making, and then of course increasing quality of care and patient safety. However, in March of 2010, the contracts between the Oregon Department of Human Services and the independent contractors who were responsible for creation of what we affectionately called HRBO, the Health Record Bank of Oregon, were dissolved. So the project was terminated and the funds were redirected to a revised project. So what we're going to talk about today is how the evaluation team from Portland State University, who was contracted initially to evaluate the implementation of the record bank, subsequently changed the scope of the evaluation to gain some insights and develop some lessons learned that could be applied to future health information technology projects, such as we're now seeing with the health information exchanges that have come with even larger federal dollars attached to them. So the research objective then that we're talking about here today is that, you know, while our initial plans called for evaluation of the record bank itself, including the communication, the structural factors, the enrollment and utilization of the records and the record banks, as the project progressed, the evaluation began to focus obviously more on the institutional structure and some of the challenges that it faced. Particularly the factors that either facilitated or impeded the implementation. So briefly, obviously we were looking at original study design that called for mixed methods to address the administrative structure and processes, structured, semi-structured interviews with key informants, content analyses of project reports, participant observations of all of the participant forums, all the engagement and outreach activities, critical event meetings amongst the partners as the project progressed, And of course, the quantitative enrollment and utilization data. The revised project evaluation project maintain the same conceptual framework, obviously with the exception of the quantitative data on enrollment and utilization, because it didn't get quite that far. So the interviews focused on perspectives of the key individuals regarding the events that led to the termination, the important events that impeded the success of the project, critical decision points that factored into the mutual and final decision to terminate the project. Because oftentimes with qualitative research, we don't say a whole lot about methods, I'm going to say a couple words about that. Sometimes in the literature, it's amazing where you see it says, we analyzed, and my question is, how? What did you look at, you know, with qualitative data? So all of our interviews were conducted by two trained evaluation team members, and with permission were digitally recorded, they were transcribed, they were inductively analyzed by three separate members independently. We did not use coding software, felt that oftentimes that constrained sometimes the word choice where the meaning isn't embodied in a particular word but in a phraseology that might have a different meaning. So we had three evaluators independently reading through the transcripts and identifying key themes. And then did a comparative analysis and ultimately synthesized those into the eight key areas that I'm going to be talking about in just a minute. A couple of significant limitations to mention. Because the project was terminated, and obviously this was a multi-million dollar project, so we were unable to gain access to representatives of the private commercial vendor, as well as several of the key members of the nonprofit organization. So they were not among our key informants interviewed. And also the case study approach, of course, limits the degree to which the findings can be generalized to other products, projects or jurisdictions, although there are some similarities that one might expect to find. So, we identified eight really key issues for administrative oversight. The first was the project oversight itself. Governance of complex projects is complex. And so the implementation requires a high degree of coordination, of oversight, of integration of the key entities amongst the projects. These included, in this case, an external advisory committee, as well as the project staff, external consultants, and the leadership of each of the three partners. So you had a lot of partners beyond even just the agencies or the three, you know, the commercial, the nonprofit, and the government agency. However, each of these entities experienced frequent personnel changes, which really contributed to a fragmented and inconsistent oversight of the project and became a real challenge to its implementation. So that leads kind of to our second point here, which was that the composition, stability, and support of the project team really matter. Our experience here suggests that success is enhanced through an appropriate mix of consultants because they oftentimes bring a great deal of technical expertise and offer some flexibility to this kind of a project as you need different levels or different types of expertise along the way. But in addition, you need stability amongst the departmental staff who bring institutional knowledge and the connections within the government agencies who will be responsible for ongoing oversight. So they have bring the institutional knowledge and thus some stability to the project. So it's really critical to think about how those are balanced among project staff in the, within a department as well as consultants to manage that flexibility and stability. So the institutional buy-in of the government agency and its assignment of permanent staff versus the use of consultants, again, who may not be vested in or connected to the organization in an ongoing way. And then the final one, developing the partnerships with commercial vendors takes time. Obviously, because a lot of the funding here is coming through the federal government into states who are then contracting with private vendors and purchasers, you have to factor in the additional time to ensure that both the government agency as well as their Medicaid or other clients are protected and ensure that the data access is clearly defined, is protected with explicit provisions that define its appropriate and allowable uses. So you think about the interests of commercial vendors who manage and have access to large databases that may contain individuals' personal health, particularly their health information, some of which may be specially protected. And in a portal where a client is ostensibly determining who has access to what types of information. And so establishing contractual provisions that align the interests of commercial vendors, of nonprofits who have their own set of interests, as well as of government agencies, and balancing those protections became actually a really difficult area of negotiation ongoing. The next three were to be consider and think about the strategic fit with organizational priorities. Health departments have many competing priorities, which is probably no surprise to most of you who work in public health or other kinds of health departments. So, but to ensure consistency with agency goals and departmental objectives, the IT projects have to be very carefully considered in the context of both their strategic alignment as well as the organizational burden of their implementation. There are great, huge, significant benefits to be attained in terms of access to care, quality, coordination, the potential to lower costs by eliminating errors, duplicative tests, transitions between providers. On the other hand, that is probably goes hand in hand then with pretty significant opportunity costs for implementing these very technically and socio-politically complex kinds of projects. So the second one, clear decision-making processes and the public good. To avoid even the perception of conflicts of interests, anytime you hear about a commercial vendor who is potentially going to have access to an incredibly rich data set of personal health information, you know, prescriptions, medication, utilization patterns, even in the absence of an explicit conflict of interest, there is oftentimes the perception of one. And so a clear decision-making process at the outset that communicates the governmental health department agency's commitment to doing this for the public good, cognizant of the privacy and security risks, is really critical. How a lot of the health information exchange and HIT information going forward is framed, we'll see in the next few years, is one of the key lessons that we learned here, that need to manage the social and public perception of these kinds of HIT projects that involve potentially public insurance or public data, and that incorporates personal health data in record banks, is going to be a critical issue going forward and really can't be overstated. And finally, getting down to the redirecting of the funds, in this case, it turned out to, and in some cases can be, a strategically preferable alternative. You know, you always hate to terminate a project, to need to go back to the funder and say, these are the challenges we faced, this is what we see going forward we need to do to overcome them. Speaking to somebody who came from actually a foundation background before moving into academia, most funders would much rather hear that and do that, as opposed to they don't want the money back. They want to see it being used and put to a good purpose and to see the funds being used in an appropriate way. In this case, we had a really great opportunity to leverage some changes in the environment coming through some of the stimulus dollars in the ARA project and the health information exchange to leverage some of the lessons that we learned through the HERBO project to be able to address some of the technical and the social policy issues that we encountered with the original project. So finally, the last two points, protecting the rights and privacy of vulnerable populations. I think that the quote here really kind of says it all, that the essence of a personal health record is not about vulnerable people being taken care of by other people. So sometimes, as somebody who comes from a clinical background, a public health background, we see ourselves as stewards and have a dual interest in both protecting the or advancing the interests in individual and population health, lowering the cost of care, ensuring access to care and quality. The government has a legitimate role and interest in those kind of activities. At the same time, governments have a legitimate role and interest in protecting the privacy and security of citizens, particularly their personal health information. So that kind of really plays out, particularly when you're talking about Medicaid populations or others who are involved with public insurance kinds of products. So for vulnerable populations who potentially have a heightened risk of harm from inappropriate utilization or disclosure of their personal health information, the state has a special responsibility that goes along with that. So balancing the autonomy and rights of your Medicaid clients with the responsible stewardship of the Medicaid funds really represents kind of a necessary tension or a balance between those kind of competing goals amongst governments as well as individuals that they represent. So the final lesson was really that a lot of these policy issues must be addressed before the technical issues can be resolved. So resolving the technical issues can really only be driven by addressing the underlying policy issues with regard to who has access, how do you authenticate, how do you track access, how do you protect specially protected health information with regard to behavioral health, diagnosis and treatment, HIV/AIDS, other specially protected health information. How do you do that across regional borders, potentially across state lines, particularly where you have urban areas that cross state borders? But a lot of these policy issues can really only be resolved by addressing their socially mediated context. So to that end, one of the key lessons learned there was really the importance of continuing to engage the public such that the issue of health information technology and health information exchange is framed in terms of its benefits. Oftentimes what we see currently in the popular media and that we sometimes are beginning to hear in some of the survey research that wasn't part of this research, but that certainly the reflections on it kind of reflect for us, is that a lot of times the health information exchange and what you're hearing about are breaches of security, identity theft, that oftentimes is transferred to health information exchange, although it actually has nothing to do with these kind of record banks or exchanges. And yet in the public's mind, the health information exchange and that becomes to be framed as a privacy and security issue, which could potentially then undermine participation and thus the success or benefits that it promises for increasing access, coordination, and lowering cost. So that was it. Thank you very much for your attention. If you have questions, there's contact information.